Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. We're going to start this hour talking with Douglas Johnson, Legislative Director for National Right to Life. There's some good news, although it's hard to discern how good the news is. There's some good news out of the Senate, and you've heard about it, of course. It's the biggest news beyond the return of Elizabeth Smart. A ban on partial birth abortion made it through the Senate today. We'll find out the ins and outs of that and some of the other news from the Senate with Douglas Johnson here in just a minute. We'll follow that conversation by talking with Stephen Chiwaga, an attorney in Philadelphia and author of the book, How to Keep Your Church Out of Court. That'll be the subject of the conversation for the remainder of this hour. Hour three of Issues Etc. is open lines for your questions and your comments. A question that I want to pose to you has to do with the return of Elizabeth Smart. She's been gone from her parents for 9 months. The details are probably well known if you follow the news. You may have noted also, with this happy return, lots of thanks being given to God, lots of people calling it an answer to prayer. Even the father himself, we'll hear from him in the third hour, calling this an answer to prayer. The parents of Elizabeth Smart, however, are members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Were they praying to the true God? Was the true God hearing their prayers, even in these dire, extenuating circumstances? That's the question for you. I'd like your answer in the third hour of Issues Etc. today. Douglas Johnson is Legislative Director of National Right to Life, based in Washington, D.C. Douglas, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good to be with you.
Let's start with what happened in the Senate today. Tell us about it.
Well, the Senate gave final approval to the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act, which is a bill, of course, to put a national ban on this abortion method in which the child is delivered feet first while still alive and then killed, brutally killed, by having the head punctured with a sharp surgical scissors or some other sharp instrument. The brain is then removed from the child and the delivery is completed. These are usually done in the fifth and sixth month of pregnancy, but sometimes even later, and they are done by the thousands, mostly on healthy babies of healthy mothers. Now, the Senate did pass this bill, but we had to beat a number of attempts to kill it through amendment first. Those were beaten back, although there was one a bad amendment that was adopted, which we are confident we'll be able to get rid of in the House of Representatives, which will take up the bill next.
What was that bad amendment, without getting too far ahead of ourselves here?
It's an amendment called the Harkin Amendment, which is an expression of support for Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion on demand. This amendment, it doesn't have any force of law, it's just an expression, but it did command a majority of a narrow majority in the Senate. And obviously we don't agree with the sentiments of the Harkin Amendment, and we would want to see that removed from the bill before it's sent to President Bush for his signature.
What was the vote total on the ban, and what was the vote total on the Harkin Amendment?
Well, the vote total on the ban in the end was 64 to 33. However, that's a bit deceptive because there were closer votes on some of the what are called substitute amendments. Substitute amendments are bills, are amendments which are really competing bills, and if a substitute amendment is adopted, then the real bill, the original bill, just gets erased. So there were substitute amendments. There was a particularly crafty one by a pro-abortion senator, Dick Durbin from Illinois, that we had to beat back, and there was a quite extreme and easy to critique one by Senator Feinstein of California. The Feinstein Amendment, just on its face, would have allowed abortion even after the child was viable, even during the third trimester, if based on any claim that this would protect the mother's health, including emotional health. So you could have a third trimester abortion under the Feinstein Amendment, simply based on an abortionist claim that this would protect or benefit the mother's emotional health. Obviously, that's no kind of a restriction at all, and that was offered and defeated. So we had to go through a couple of days, but the final vote was good, and we're encouraged, really, that we have almost two-thirds of the Senate. We know we have two-thirds of the House from past votes. The president strongly supports the bill. 70% of the public in the Gallup poll in January said they want this bill passed. And we have, we know from a decision in the year 2000, we have four justices on the U.S. Supreme Court who believe that there is no constitutional right to deliver, mostly deliver, a living baby and then stab her through the head with the scissors. The problem we have is in that case, in the year 2000, five justices, a one-vote majority, said that there is such a right, that Roe versus Wade covers even partial birth abortion. And, 33 senators have voted in agreement with that today. So we're rather dismayed by that. We do hope that by the time this issue of partial birth abortions gets before the U.S. Supreme Court again, that there'll be at least five justices who will be willing to back off from that extreme position that they took in the earlier case.
You detailed a bit of the Feinstein Amendment, but you only mentioned the Durbin Amendment. You said it was kind of a crafty little thing. Tell us about Dick Durbin's amendment that fell down.
Well, Durbin is a, in my view, someone who is quite smooth, but he's also very disingenuous. And in this case, his marketing strategy was to come up with an amendment that was labeled as a ban on late-term abortions that had lots of pages, lots of words, lots of moving parts, but at bottom had so many loopholes, overlapping loopholes, loopholes within loopholes, that it really wouldn't have prevented a single abortion. And yet it was so artfully constructed that to the uninitiated, it looked like it did something. And his claim was that he was seeking a middle ground and that he would get support from some of the pro-life senators and some of the pro-abortion senators. Well, that didn't happen. He got support from pro-abortion senators and not enough to pass his amendment. So it was an artful piece of political theater, but the actual amendment really has the purpose of providing political cover. There are some senators who want to never vote in a way as to offend the National Abortion Rights Action League or these other politically potent pro-abortion groups, and so they don't want to vote for the ban on partial birth abortions because that would offend those groups. But on the other hand, they don't want to offend 70% of their constituents. And so they had a need for something to vote for that looked like a ban but really didn't do anything and didn't offend the pro-abortion lobby. And that's why the Durbin Amendment was invented, to have something that didn't do anything but looked like something that senators could vote for, go back home, tell their constituents, we voted to, quote, ban late-term abortions, but then vote against the real ban, the partial birth abortion ban.
Does that also explain the many voting for the ban during the Clinton administration when the veto of that law was virtually assured?
Well, we went through this exercise in those years as well. Every year we've had to beat back what we call these phony bans before we can get a vote on the real ban on partial birth abortions. But really, most senators today stuck with the positions that they had voted in earlier years. There were not flip-flops anymore. Some senators changed their positions on this issue, some years ago after the initial votes and the wave of public revulsion when people found out what partial birth abortion was. But we didn't see that yesterday. People voted their previously voted positions. There are a number of new senators who, for the most part, voted as expected. So we got up to that, almost two-thirds margin. Now, there are some more steps along the way. The House has to deal with this. We have to get rid of the Harkin Amendment. But we are over the biggest hurdle now as far as getting this bill to President Bush, and we are quite optimistic that in due course, in the not real distant future, we will be able to get that done.
What are the chances of this bill withstanding judicial scrutiny, even with the president's signature?
Well, I got out of the habit some years ago of trying to predict what the Supreme Court would do on any matter. But I do think that if we look at that decision in the year 2000 on the Nebraska law, which banned partial birth abortions, there were four justices on the court, and they're still there, who said that was perfectly fine. There was nothing in the Constitution to say that the state couldn't prohibit this brutal method where the baby is delivered feet first alive until just the head is inside the mother, and then the baby stabbed through the head. They said Nebraska can prohibit that. But five justices said, no, they can't. So now this is a little different bill. The Congress has tightened up the definition to make it even more clear what a partial birth abortion is. They have put in a lot of facts, findings from congressional hearings that this is never medically necessary, that indeed it is a method that exposes the woman herself to some substantial risks to her health. But all of that would have to be assessed by the Supreme Court whenever it gets up there, and they have the last word. But that could take a while. It has to work its way up from the lower courts. And we just hope that when it does come again before the Supreme Court, that we've got at least five justices who will be willing to back away from that extreme pro-abortion position that they took in the Nebraska case, and to begin to move this country back towards some increased respect for innocent human life.
How did those potential Democratic presidential candidates serving in the Senate, how did they vote on this ban on partial birth abortion?
They all voted against the ban. In fact, the first thing that happened yesterday was that Senators who are Democratic presidential candidates flew in from diverse parts of the country just so they could be there to vote in favor of the Harkin Amendment to endorse Roe versus Wade. Senator Bob Graham of Florida had open-heart surgery recently and had not been in Washington and not been working. He was recuperating. He flew back to Washington, and this was his first vote since open-heart surgery. He flew in special so he could vote for the Harkin Amendment to endorse Roe versus Wade. So it seems as if those four are trying to outdo each other in showing their fidelity and their allegiance to the most extreme pro-abortion advocacy groups, and they all voted against the ban, even on final passage, where they were in a fairly small minority.
I'm asking you to speculate, but when will President Bush see this bill on his desk with pen in hand?
I don't think we can say that yet. We do have to go through the process in the House. If the Senate bill had been entirely undamaged or unblemished, then it would have been possible to shortcut it, so to speak. But because the Harkin Amendment was adopted, we are going to have to do some work there to make sure that we can get rid of that. We don't want that in the bill that goes to the president for his signature. When it does in due course go to the president and he signs it, it is true that the pro-abortion groups will go into federal court and that the enforcement of the law will be blocked while these legal issues are litigated. That's almost invariable with both state and federal laws that touch on the subject of abortion, particularly if they try to break any new ground. So it's regrettable, but that is par for the course. And we are going to have to be prepared for some period of uncertainty while the courts review this matter.
Douglas Johnson, thank you again for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you.
Douglas Johnson is Legislative Director of National Right to Life, based in Washington, D.C. We've been talking about the ban on partial birth abortion that was passed today in the U.S. Senate. If you would like to visit National Right to Life on the web, you can do so by going to their website at nrlc.org. That's nrlc.org. They also have a telephone number by which you can contact them. Area code 202-626-8800. That's area code 202-626-8800, the number for National Right to Life in Washington, D.C. We'll spend the rest of this hour, the remainder of this hour, to the bottom of the hour and then beyond, again to the top of the hour, with Stephen Chiwaga. He's an attorney in Philadelphia and author of the book How to Keep Your Church Out of Court. That will be the subject of our conversation. If you'd like to join us during this, our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Stephen, welcome to Issues Etc.
Good afternoon. Nice to be with you.
How common is it, Stephen, for churches to find themselves in court?
Well, I think it's becoming more common rather than less common. It used to be that courts got substantial protection under the law, churches did. They were considered immune from a lot of the laws that applied to everybody else because of their nonprofit and charitable status, but that's changing. More and more legislatures are in different states are taking those protections away.
Now, does this mean that the majority of the time that a church finds itself in court, it is being assailed with litigation from the outside?
Well, I think there are any number of reasons that a church can be in court. The book and what I was writing about focuses on liability issues, on issues when they would be sued. A church can find itself in court for a number of reasons relating to financial matters and other things. And so really no distinction anymore between churches and other organizations.
Let's begin with a theological distinction, if we could.
I'm going to be in a little trouble, but you'll help me, I'm sure.
Well, let's see if we can wade our way through it. Having to do with the church's place in society, whether or not the church is in its own estimation or in the estimation of society, simply another institution like any other institution. From the law's perspective, I'm talking about the legal perspective.
Right.
Is the Christian church, or any other church for that matter, simply another institution before the law?
I would argue that that's certainly the more common trend, and that the way you see that, as I say, is that states are refusing to extend or are in some cases removing the traditional protection they'd offered churches because of their historical status as a spiritual body and as a charitable body, and that's just less and less true now as they're more and more seen as a what we in the law call a deep pocket, an object for litigation just like any other.
And certainly from a theological perspective, the church would see itself as, while located within the civil realm, not properly speaking a part of the civil realm, while it subjects itself to the laws of the civil realm. Does that pretty accurately sum up the situation from the church's perspective?
I think that's right, and I think as many of your listeners probably know, when you're involved in your church, you become a member of your church because you are seeking spiritual guidance or spiritual nurturing. You don't join a church so that you can have to worry about property issues and liability issues, and so it's easy to overlook. The people who are in charge of maintaining churches or pastors and so on, it's not that and shouldn't be uppermost on their mind. But ignoring these trends in the law, I think can cause problems.
Was there a time in the law when things were different for the church, when the church was in essence given hands-off treatment with regard to the law?
Yes, I think that reflected, as you've been saying, society's view that churches were entitled to special protection, and because of the good works that churches did, that they were entitled to sort of be able to rise above the fighting and the skirmishing that goes on in litigation and so on. And that view was reflected in the way various states would write laws that would exempt churches from liability suits. They would literally say, well, you cannot sue a church for its negligence. If you slip and fall outside their front door and on some stairs that maybe were loose, ordinarily if it were somebody's house or something like that, you could sue, but because it's a church, you can't. And I think that was a clear reflection of what society at one time viewed churches as being, which was sort of above that sort of thing and entitled to protection, in addition to which, of course, historically, churches have not been, in all cases, the most wealthy organizations by any means. And there was certainly a reflection that litigation involving a church could result in that church going out of business, and the loss to society would outweigh any gain that would result from that.
So is it safe to say that those exemptions, be they formal or informal, before the law that pertained to churches in the past, or if not gone, quickly fleeing away?
I would say they're eroding. I think to quickly and law rarely go together. It's always a time-consuming process. But in my neighboring state of New Jersey, where there's a lot of litigation and court decisions on this, the trend is, a court will write an opinion that will create this kind of an exception to what was otherwise a pretty generally held rule. And then the next court, a year or two later, will write about another exception. And before you know it, after 5 or 10 years, what was once a hard and fast rule now is full of holes. And that's, I think, the trend that we see. Plus, legislatures are not enacting new and additional protections. As churches are exposed to new kinds of liability, from what we've been reading about in the papers involving discrimination of various forms and that sort of thing, they're not being protected the way they were traditionally from negligence suits.
There was a case several years ago, a Baptist church down south. They decided that they weren't going to be paying withholding for the staff of that church, and there was a big ruckus. Eventually, it ended with the pastor and some church leaders being led out under protest. The church property was seized, I believe, either by the state or by the IRS because of failure to pay these things. But the claim was, look, we're the church. we shouldn't be subjected to these things. Did, in your opinion, with that brief outline, did they have a leg to stand on?
Well, I think that most judges would say to that, would cite Jesus' teachings that we must render to Caesar's what is Caesar's and render to God's what is God's. And a judge would say, well, you know, taxes and property fees and that sort of thing imposed by secular authorities must be paid by churches. And the fact that you are a church, of course, you're entitled to certain exemptions from taxation and so on and so forth. But that's all at the pleasure of secular leaders. And within the secular realm, if you want to be of the secular world, then you must pay due heed to secular law. I think that's the opinion of the average judge that gets this kind of case.
Someone once explained to me when I was a parish pastor, and this was a lawyer actually, in the case of a lawsuit, a liability lawsuit that was being brought against another church, but he was talking to me in connection with it, and he said, look, the church, the local congregation, in the eyes of the law, is an incorporated entity. It's a corporation, and that's how the law views, should be viewing, in the cases of these kind of liability issues, the church. Could you explain that to us? What does it mean to be a corporation in the eyes of the law?
Well, it literally means that you will find those of you people who are listening who are part of a board or among the lay leaders of the church. You will find that when the church was started, whether it was 10 years ago or 100 years ago, some registration was made by the church body with the state authorities. In Pennsylvania, it would be with the Department of State or the Department of Revenue. And you have to register yourself as a legal entity, the same way a corporation does, or your local barber shop or your local flower shop. And you will take on, usually you'll register yourself in the name of the church, and you will have registrars will have been appointed. And that is what, in order to, for example, claim tax-exempt status, if the IRS comes to investigate to see whether, in fact, you are entitled to be free of federal tax, they will need to know that you have registered yourself as a church body. It's also a way of having you declare yourself to be a religious entity with some standing and not just, a couple of folks who are operating out of somebody's house or something like that.
Only a minute before we go to this break, what about the couple of folks that are operating out of their house, and pretty soon they're operating out of a rented building, but they've never incorporated? Have they broken the law?
I don't know that they've broken the law. It would depend on how long they've been doing it and how big their body is and so forth. I mean, you know, we can all agree that there shouldn't be, there's not such a level of legal intrusion here that should prevent people who want to worship from worshiping together freely. That's protected under the Constitution, of course. I would say that if they are meeting regularly and have a body of people that is, you know, gets together regularly, they should certainly look into whether they want to register themselves with their state in order, as I say, to obtain the benefits of that, tax benefits and so on and so forth.
Stephen Chiwaga is our guest. He's an attorney in Philadelphia, author of the book How to Keep Your Church Out of Court. When we come back, we'll get a definition of liability, one of the biggest issues for the church in the realm of the law, and then we'll talk about what that actually means. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The courts of justice are there to protect our rights and to right the wrongs that occur between men. Should Christians take one another to court? What's the difference between conflict resolution and Christian reconciliation? Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March is called Confession and Forgiveness by Ted Kober. You can order the book online by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on the book, and you can even read an excerpt. Issuesetc.org, or order by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040. Now, when you call, be sure to ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March, Confession and Forgiveness, 1-800-325-3040, weekdays during regular business hours. 1-800-325-3040.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. The Senate Finance Committee heard testimony yesterday on improving our welfare system. Both Republicans and Democrats agree that the welfare reform law of 1996 has helped families, but it's about to expire, and new legislation needs to be passed to keep the reforms alive. David Brody reports from Capitol Hill.
All senators know that the ultimate goal is to see more families off welfare and move on to stable-paying jobs, but they disagree on how to do it. One of the main controversial elements is over how much money the government should fund for marriage programs. Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson represented the Bush plan at the hearing.
We will be targeting $200 million in federal funds towards developing innovative approaches to support healthy marriages and healthy families.
That includes marriage counseling, so families stay intact. Democrat Max Baucus disagrees with that approach.
I remain concerned about the administration's proposal to promote marriage with federal funding. Marriage is a personal and private choice, not one the government should interfere with.
Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley begs to differ.
I believe that we need to do more to promote healthy families and that this will have a significant impact on child well-being.
The whole philosophy behind pumping lots of money into marriage programs is the belief that kids from intact families will be better off and eventually not end up on welfare themselves. Secretary Thompson says it just makes sense.
You and I and all the members of this committee know that the best environment for raising children is a family in which the mother and father are married to each other.
The full Senate is expected to vote on welfare reform sometime this summer. For Family News in Focus, I'm David Brody in Washington.
Senators are also discussing work requirements in the law. People on welfare are required to work 30 hours a week. Democrats want to keep it that way. Republicans want to increase the requirement to 40. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Janet Parzel is the guest host on the next Focus on the Family, a program on purity and second chances, as told by guest Lisa Bevere, author of the best-selling book, Kiss the Girls and Made Them Cry. Lisa uses fairy tales to relate certain aspects of women's desires, saying we should hold out for that prince, meaning Jesus. It's all on the next Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
How can confession and absolution help resolve conflict in the church? Find out with the new book, Confession and Forgiveness, published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Confession and Forgiveness is the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March, 1-800-325-3040. You can find out more about this book on the Internet at issuesetc.org and click What's New, Confession and Forgiveness, Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March.
They wanted me to thank everybody for all the great support, the search efforts, and especially the continued hope and prayers that were sent their way. They believe indeed those prayers were answered.
That was Salt Lake City Mayor Rocky Anderson yesterday expressing the appreciation of Elizabeth Smart's parents. Now, Elizabeth Smart, of course, was abducted in that area of the country about 9 months ago. She was found yesterday, and everyone's happy about it. Thanks be to God that this young lady has been returned to her family. We pray that her recovery from that abduction is quick and that it is done all in accordance, and that the people who are responsible for this go to jail for a very, very long time. But it raises a question in my mind, and we'll hear in the third hour during Open Lines from the father of Elizabeth Smart, and he's talking about the answer to prayers, as did the city official there as well, talking about the answer to prayers. My question for you is, given the fact that the Smart family are members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and they say God heard their prayers, I'm wondering from you, which God heard their prayers, the God of Mormonism or the God of Christianity? That's coming up in 30 minutes. Open Lines, that's your question to think about for the next 30 minutes, and give me a call then. Our phone number is then and now 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We're talking about the church and its liability before the law, how to keep your church out of court. Stephen Chawaga is our guest, an attorney in Philadelphia. Steve, back to this issue of liability. Could you give us a good thumbnail definition of liability?
Yes, liability is when you're required to compensate someone who's been injured as a result of either something you didn't do and should have done, or something you did do that caused their injury. And it's something that is found by a court of law. And if they make such a finding, then you can be liable to a person to compensate them in monetarily for the injuries that they've suffered at your hand.
Are we talking only about physical injuries, like you mentioned, a slip and fall before the break?
Well, in the usual case, the church has to be worried about that would involve something involving church property that either wasn't looked after that should have been or that causes an injury. Yes, it would usually be some sort of a physical injury to somebody that they want to be compensated for.
Okay, does this mean, we spoke earlier about the church being a corporation, does this mean that every member of a congregation bears equal liability, say, should someone injure themselves on church property?
No, and that's one of the advantages of being incorporated as a legal entity, and why I was saying before the break that folks who don't have that status should give it some thought. If you are incorporated as a corporation, or specifically as a church would be, as what's known as a non-profit corporation, then the assets of the church could be attached to pay a judgment, but not individual members. On the other hand, if you and a couple of folks are worshiping at your house and somebody is injured, then you personally, if you're the owner of the house and you're found to be responsible, then you could have personal liability to whoever is injured. So that's the distinction between being incorporated as a legal entity and not being incorporated that way.
What about that kind of halfway house of, yes, we are an incorporated church, and yet the property upon which we regularly meet is not ours, but we either rent time or we are using it pro bono from someone else. Someone else owns the property.
Well, you need to know some more about what the kind of the nature of the liability was. If somebody trips and falls on a staircase on property that you're renting, then most likely the landlord would be the responsible party for not keeping that staircase in proper shape. If, however, you as the tenant have stacked prayer books or something on the stairs and have made it hazardous, then your organization could be exposed. But in the usual case, it's the owner of the property that would bear the first responsibility.
The biggest story that was in the news last year regarding the church and the law, of course, was the sexual abuse story out of the Roman Catholic Church. Does this fall legally under the same kind of umbrella of liability?
Well, there is a more interesting case because it depends very much. You know, in the Catholic Church, the priests are not hired by an individual parish or an individual church. They're hired, I use the word hired, they're called, of course, but in legal terms, they work for and are responsible to a diocese. So that as these suits are becoming coming up for trial and they're in the news and so on, we're seeing that various dioceses, like the Diocese of Massachusetts and the Catholic Church, are exposed and are talking about filing for bankruptcy protection and that sort of thing. Different churches are structured very differently. The Catholic Church, of course, being very what we would say hierarchical. It's the diocese that is looked to pay these judgments. If your church is not that way, if you have responsibility for hiring your own pastor, and you have not done an investigation that would have determined that pastor had something in his or her past and should not have been hired, then you as an individual church could be liable to somebody who claims to have been injured as a result of something the pastor did that you should have found out about, if they can prove all that you should have found out about during the hiring process. If, as on the other hand, you're not the hiring, you didn't, you know, you, you a pastor is assigned to you by your denomination, then the liability would probably go elsewhere.
Now, am I right? There are some states that are taking as a matter of law, some states, that people who serve in these positions, such as ministers of religion, or in some cases counselors, therapists, are being required before they are hired in that state to have a background check done on them to alleviate any possible liability in the future.
Well, that's correct, and that's also something that's being done. I'm an Episcopalian, and so we are a reasonably hierarchical church with a bishop and a diocese. And in our diocese in Pennsylvania, the bishop has imposed a requirement that all, not only ministers, but also people we would hire to for Sunday school teaching, or even office staff, anyone who comes in contact with other people, and particularly minors, must be checked, and also have take classes, and be certified to have taken classes in these areas. And that is, of course, a way that the diocese seeks to protect itself from the accusation that, well, they didn't do anything to try to weed out people who might be a problem, or take steps to educate people on what to look for. It's more of a church-generated process than a legislative-generated process, but there are, in different states, there are very different initiatives, that's true.
So it can come from either direction. It could either be, say, the bishop of a diocese saying, we will impose this restriction upon this hiring condition upon ourselves, or it could be the state from the outside saying, anyone who is hired into a position within the church or these sensitive contact positions must, by law, have a background check done.
That's right. But in both cases, the real origin are these lawsuits that you mentioned to begin with, where judges and juries are finding liability on the part of individual churches and dioceses for negligence in not checking. So sometimes the state will try to address that problem by imposing a legislation. Sometimes the diocese itself will take it upon itself to try to correct a problem or to prevent a problem from occurring.
The worst case scenario was kind of played out in the Boston Archdiocese of the Roman Catholic Church, where Cardinal Bernard Law seems to have had, these things have yet to be proven, seems to have had some knowledge of abuse taking place. But there was very little reporting to civil authorities. Is there an issue of liability there when a crime is suspected of having been committed by someone in the employ of the church, but those responsible do not report the crime to civil authority?
Well, here, Ty, you've touched on a very, very sensitive issue, and I want to sort of be a little careful in answering, because it's a very interesting question, and it calls into conflict some very, very important but conflicting principles, one being society's interest in preventing crime and seeing it doesn't happen, but on the other hand, a pastor's long-held place in society as a confessor, as a counselor, as a pastoral figure, and, you know, we don't want to do things that will make that relationship go away, because that's of such importance to so many people. So it is. I do not believe that there's still such a thing as the priest penitent privilege, and there is certainly still a freedom to go talk to your minister or pastor about things that you want to have kept confidential, with the expectation that they will be kept confidential. Where that line gets crossed varies in different states, and pastors in particular need to know, when and if a line is crossed and what their responsibilities are. But by and large, I think that the privilege still holds.
We're talking with Steve Chiwaga. He's an attorney in Philadelphia and author of the book, How to Keep Your Church Out of Court. If you've got a question or a comment on churches, on litigation, on their liability, you can give us a call now, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Another issue, Steve, that comes up with regard to hiring has to do with job discrimination or hiring discrimination. I'll speak from my perspective for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
There would be in place in my church body theological reasons, stated positions of the church, why we would not hire, for instance, an active homosexual as a pastor or a teacher in a parochial school, these kind of things. Now, other churches don't have those restrictions. However, would such restrictions, theological positions, be honored under the law to exempt a church body like mine from being accused or found guilty of hiring discrimination?
This is an area that is largely untested, so far as I'm aware. There aren't a lot of cases that have really come down on this yet, although we might expect in the next 5 or 10 years, if things go the way they go, we would see some things. I believe that churches certainly should be able to maintain some degree of of privilege in this area and some degree of flexibility in terms of hiring people who are not out of the step with their particular beliefs. And therefore, certainly, you know, on a religious ground, if it is important to the position that somebody be of a particular religious background, that's an area where a church would have the flexibility to hire somebody where an ordinary company might not. And the same is true in this area. I think that if it is it is truly a tenet of the church's practice, you know, from a theological standpoint, to take a certain view of that, that I believe they should have the freedom and the flexibility to continue to operate under that practice. A lot of times the issue is moot because a church, many churches only hire a handful of people and therefore are not subject to the anti-discrimination laws that govern a bigger company. Some of these laws apply to organizations that hire as few as 5 or 6 people, but even in that case, some churches fall below that. And it only applies to full-time people. So if you have a part-time janitor or a religious education person that works a few hours a week, then that wouldn't count against that.
Very often a congregation, a Christian congregation, is not found alone. It often enters into or has as part of its, for lack of a better word, part of its ministry, a parochial day school, a preschool. What are the issues of liability regarding that entity when it's directly attached as an organizational entity to a Christian congregation?
Right, and therein lies a very important point. Those organizations are, I think, in most cases, found to be much more subject to secular law than a church would be, so that even though a church might be exempt from discrimination laws or hiring restrictions, your school, even a parochial school, will not be, because you open yourself up to the public and you invite people in for what is largely a secular purpose, although you certainly would have a religious component. And the law treats those schools as being much more subject to the general mainstream of law than the church itself is. And that's an area where a church who is not mindful of that can get into trouble.
So in other words, the leadership of a congregation should not assume that the same exemptions or privileges that attach to the congregation would also attach to any other endeavor the congregation wishes to launch, like a school or some type of an outreach program or some type of community service program.
That's correct. And another area where we see this is, suppose you have a gymnasium or a hall that you let a community basketball team use in the winter or on the weekend. Well, I think it's all too easy to assume that, well, we're being very nice to let these people come in, and, you know, heaven forbid somebody should get hurt or trip over a something on the floor, well, that can't be our responsibility because we've been nice enough to let them in. Well, that's not true. You have a duty for people who you invite onto your premises, even if it's not for a religious purpose. You have an obligation to make sure that within reason that you have looked around the premises, and that any problem or issue that you're aware of that could cause liability, you have taken reasonable steps to address.
What about property use? Let's say we have a large parochial school attached to a congregation, and there's all sorts of classroom space. They allow, say, the Boy Scouts, not directly attached to their congregation, just a local branch of the Boy Scouts, to come in on Wednesday. Maybe a reading group from the community come in on Thursday. If they were approached by a group that they might have some trouble with, say, a local, for the sake of argument, a local branch of GLAD or something like that, said, we'd like to use your space too, are they obligated under the law to give equal access to their facilities?
Well, I think the law, the recent cases that have come down that apply to public schools and that have required public schools to allow organizations of different persuasions, shall we say, to use space after school, have not been extended to private churches who are still entitled, I think, to determine for themselves who and what organizations can use their space, just as any other, just as particularly in a religious sense, where there are certain important beliefs that an organization, a religious organization, will have, that they don't care to compromise, and they shouldn't be expected to. So I would say the answer to that is generally no. A church can't be compelled to open up their doors to whomever might want to use their space.
On the issue of insurance, there's an entire chapter later in your book on insurance, and most churches want to be very conscientious, in at least with regard to liability, because they understand that they're owners of property with regard to insurance. What should a church, how should they cover their bases insurance-wise?
Well, I think you have two concerns that jump out at you if you are the owner of a building, particularly a sanctuary in which the church is, in which you worship, and that is fire, lightning, windstorm damage to the building, and then secondly, liability. Usually when you go out in the market and buy insurance, you get a policy that covers you against both of those risks, and so you don't really have to go hunting around separately. Because those are the major concerns of churches, and therefore things that insurance companies will cover. When you get into the area of discrimination, as we've been talking about, and hiring practices, those are often risks that an insurance company will not insure you against, or at least not without a significant additional premium, because of the fact that they're high publicity cases and very much in the news these days. But in terms of but which doesn't mean you can't get coverage. It may mean that that has to be separately paid for, or there may be certain restrictions as to how much and what kind you can get. But these are questions you or your insurance agent need to ask, and there are many insurance agents all over the country who specialize in finding insurance for churches. Also, if you are part of a denomination, often the denomination will have obtained a policy that can be applied to all the churches in the area, and you can save significantly on your insurance costs by participating in that group program.
You mentioned before that the church is not often in the community considered to be an entity with deep pockets, therefore hadn't in the past always been the target of lawsuits. However, with the advent of insurance and large policies, suddenly there is a deep pocket standing behind the church. Has that invited more lawsuits?
That's absolutely right, and that is a consequence. That is a consequence, just as it is in other aspects of society. As insurance, lawyers understand how insurance works and that that's available, it does. There is a certain aspect of that that's true, that that does tend to promote and provoke suits that might not be particularly meritorious, just because you don't have to feel guilty that the church itself might be paying, that, you know, it's all just insurance. I think people fail to realize that, you know, the cost of defending a suit can be more expensive than the cost of the judgment itself. And even though in this area, I wouldn't necessarily expect that if you as a church are hit with a lawsuit and have to defend it, that that would mean your insurance rates go up the way it's true with auto insurance and other things. The cost is obviously borne by society as a whole, and that is true. I would agree.
Should a congregation, if not keep a legal counsel on, and I'm talking about perhaps a more sizable congregation, keep legal counsel on retainer, should they maintain a relationship with a lawyer at all times?
Sure, I think that's a good idea. Of course, a lot of people count among their parishioners a attorney or three or four or five, and those are the folks, just like the accountants in the organization are the ones that do the books, and the architects are the ones that get asked every time there's a new building project. I think that's your first source of helpful advice. But when it comes to specialized areas like insurance and litigation, if you're in that, then I think it is a wise idea to keep out for special counsel. Sometimes your denomination can help with that. Sometimes your insurance company will assign you counsel if you are in a lawsuit, and that would usually be somebody the insurance company is comfortable as having experience in the area. So that's another source of an attorney that, you know, isn't particularly costly.
I guess someone might be saying at this point, look, you two have talked about the church and the possible liabilities here for the better part of an hour, but you haven't yet mentioned the First Amendment. Where does the First Amendment come into play in all of these issues, the free exercise of religion not being inhibited in any way? Is it a one-size-fits-all protection from all liabilities?
The First Amendment is not usually found to be a protection for things like property liability and so on and those sorts of things. The run-of-the-mill slips and falls and accidents that might take place on property. The First Amendment should be and remains a cornerstone of our legal system, and therefore these newer kinds of cases that we're seeing involving lawsuits, you know, disputes with ministers over whether they should be they can be terminated, and discrimination suits involving conduct by ministers and so on. That's where the First Amendment is often invoked by the person being sued, and that's where certain protections still apply. This is an area that's developing, and that's going to be, I think, a source of some interesting cases over the next few years.
Stephen Chiwaga, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Well, it was my pleasure. I enjoyed talking to you very much.
Stephen Chiwaga is an attorney in Philadelphia. He is author of this book called How to Keep Your Church Out of Court. You can purchase the book at the website for Concordia Publishing House. Here's the address, www.cph.org. It's www.cph.org. You can also order How to Keep Your Church Out of Court by calling Concordia Publishing House tomorrow during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Now, we've come to the end of a conversation that might have struck fear in the hearts of some people saying, are we adequately covered? All we've heard about is liability. This is a scary prospect. Well, you know, the church exists in the civil realm. Properly speaking, the church has a realm of its own, but that realm, we live out our daily lives within the civil realm. And that means being subject to governing authorities. Do you think that this is what Paul meant when he wrote those words in Romans chapter 13? The church wasn't even legally recognized in the Roman Empire in those days. And yet I do not think that the situation of the modern church, especially in our society, was overlooked by Paul's words. I think he anticipated, or at least the Holy Spirit, who spoke through him, anticipated even our situation. Highly litigious, there's no doubt about it. Could we do with less lawsuits? Of course we could. Would we like to be able to conduct church without incorporating and getting large insurance policies? Sure we would, but that's not the world God has given us to live in. That's not the world that God has placed us in to be His messengers. We have a mission to do, but that means even while we're doing it, we are obeying and observing the laws of the governing authorities that God has given us. When we come back, we're going to talk about whether or not the prayers for Elizabeth Smart were heard.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.